the end of yesterday's talk that I hadn't turned this on at the beginning. So can everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. I just want to point at the screen, even though the machine's over there. Okay. It's not working. All right. So courage in fearful times. So just to give folks a reminder of what we're doing in this Living Word session this week. Yesterday, we were looking at Thomas Aquinas, how he understands fear, the kind of distinctions that he draws. And we used some Thomas to look at some passages in the Hebrew Bible. We're going to continue some of that work this morning. Actually, we didn't quite get done. There's at least one more text I want us to look at. So we're going to do a little bit more with the Hebrew Bible this morning. And then shift into one of my favorite guys, Martin Luther, and then a little more Thomas. Still trying to lay some groundwork, get some terms on the table, some vocabulary as we move forward in the week. Then Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we're going to look more at contemporary figures. Martin Luther King tomorrow, James Baldwin on Thursday, and Ta-Nehisi Coates on Friday. Trying to ask, how do these thinkers understand fear in the experience of, as people of color in this country? What kind of fears arise as we try and wrestle with the challenges of racism and fight racism in ourselves and in our society? And what do these resources have to say about the church and the church's role in the structures of racism? Okay, they're each going to have different perspectives, some more positive, some more negative, but all, I think, helpfully critical. Okay, so that's what we're doing. So, today, just a reminder to folks who are just joining us for the first time, the theme here at Holden this season is Fear Not, taken from the book of Isaiah. And so yesterday, we did a little work looking at Isaiah 43, talking about what kind of fears are present in this text, and are those fears justified? Why are the folks afraid, and does their fear make sense? And again, a little recap for those of you who weren't here, or for those of you who, like me, forget things when they go to sleep and then have to start again the fresh day. I said with Thomas Aquinas, he works to sort of draw together the Christian tradition, the Bible, other traditions, to try and see how fear can be understood in both negative and positive terms. Right? How at the end of the day, fear is really just sort of a natural feeling, right, for Thomas. We experience fear because we are contingent creatures, creatures who suffer losses. And when something we love can be lost, can be taken, we experience fear. It's a passion that comes over us. And so as Thomas said, I said drawing on St. Augustine, the reason that we fear is simply because we love. And if we stop fearing, then that's not a good thing. Because we've stopped loving, we've stopped being committed to things, to people, and ultimately to God for Thomas and a lot of these thinkers. But what we can do is we can fear in the wrong way. Right? So Thomas talks about the ways that we can fear when we ought not, when there's no actual threat. Right? And there's some sense of that I tried to point to in some of the political responses today. Right? Afraid of things that aren't actually happening, afraid of economic losses that aren't the responsibility of the folks you're trying to blame. You can fear the loss of something that's not good for you. And Thomas says that's not a good fear either. If you're afraid of having to be a better person, this was one of the little things Leah Rasmussen did in his talk on the environment yesterday, is everybody's, you know, there's a little cartoon where everyone is complaining, you know, why are we going to do all this environmental change if it's all a hoax? And the person said, you know, oh no, we're making the world a better place all because of a hoax. So there's this fear that we're going to lose something, like our attachment to fossil fuels. We're going to lose our position in society. We might not actually need those things. Right? Those things might actually be evil or harmful for us or harmful for others. Right? And finally, we can fear things that are genuine losses, but that fear can become excessive and can overwhelm us. And that's where we get to issues with like anxiety, Thomas thinks. We become anxious about these unforeseen losses that are coming in the future. We fixate on them. We go deeper into them, and we can't escape those fears. So what I said, Thomas's approach to this is an ancient one. The idea is that we need to train ourselves to fear rightly, to fear the right kinds of things in the right kinds of ways in the right times and places. And so to help us begin some of that training, we looked at some biblical passages. We only got to Isaiah 43, 1 to 7 yesterday, and I need us to at least get through Amos 3, 1 to 15. So, today we're going to start with the Bible. So, if you could please find three or four people, or two or three others, for groups of three or four, kind of in and around your area, rotate your chairs, If you want to mix it up, if you want to talk to somebody who didn't talk to you yesterday, if you want to not talk with your spouse anymore and look in the other direction, that's encouraged. No judgment there. So find a few other folks, make little groups of three or four. And I want you to read these passages from the book of Amos and talk about these four questions together. Okay? Who or what is being feared in the text? This text talks about fear, but who or what is the object of fear? Why is there this fear? Right? Why is this thing a fearful thing to these people? Okay. Then the third one is kind of a two-parter. Is fear appropriate in this text? By that I mean, are the people being admonished to stop fearing, or are they being invited to fear? And what's that look like? Also, do you think the people should be afraid? Right? There's kind of two different questions there built into one. Is the text saying fear is okay? What do you think about the fears the people are talking about or hitting on? And finally, do you experience this kind of fear in our own lives? Okay, so a little chatting in small groups that we'll come back together and share our learnings. Let's take about 8 minutes, 8 to 10 minutes.
All right, so Amos 3, who or what is being feared? What did you find? What did you think?
That's wrath.
The punishment of the Lord.
All right. Wrath. Right. Israel is to be is afraid of God's wrath, God's punishment. Okay. Why? Why is there this fear?
Disobedience.
Mm-hmm. Right. Say more.
Yeah, they haven't been following God.
Okay. There's been some issues with disobedience. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's put some more flesh on that. How have they been disobedient? And someone was really pointing out, I do a cruel trick to you and making you just dive into text without like giving you an introduction to the text or teaching you the history. I'm expecting some people in the room to help other people, but I'll fill in some quick details for you, right? So in the book of Amos, Amos is a prophet. Figured that much out, I hope. We're good? Prophet. Amos lives in the south, right, the kingdom of Judah. But he's prophesying in the north, the kingdom of Israel. Okay. Amos is a tender of sycamore trees and a herdsman. People usually interpret it to mean like some poor shepherd. That's not actually correct. The Hebrew words in here describe somebody who has lots of herds. So he's more like a rancher or a wealthy landowner who has lots of land. So he's somebody who has money, and he's from out of town, and he's showing up to criticize the people of the north. So the example I give my students in class is imagine the former president of Mexico, a guy named Vicente Fox, who was a big Coca-Cola magnate, multi-million billionaire. Imagine if he showed up in Washington, D.C. one day and started saying, America is going to burn. Right? God is tired of this. Right? Canada is going to invade from the north. Right? The Irish are going to get saucy and come over from the east. Your walls are going to fall. You know, nothing's going to be left. You're going to be torn to shreds. Adios, bye con Dios. That's it. Right? How would that be received, you think?
Yeah. Not great. Yeah.
I'm imagining, yeah, even CNN probably wouldn't even give that a positive. Yeah. So that's the context, more or less. Guy from the south, lots of money, to criticize folks in the north. But I'm going to pick up this a little bit more. What does their disobedience look like?
Wealth inequality.
Well.
Maybe a little bit of idol worship?
Yeah, I'll
a little bit. Yeah.
Oppression.
Idols. Oppression. False gods.
All of the above. Okay. The big things, the idol worship things were related to the oppression and the false gods throughout the book. When we look at other places, if you go on a little bit further on the page into chapter 4, it says, "Hear this word, you cows of Bashan who are on Mount Samaria, who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, etc., etc. Trade the poor for a pair of sandals." The text is just rife with all these criticisms about the injustice, the economic injustice of the people of Israel. And again, for more context, this is a time and place when Israel thinks they're doing pretty darn well for themselves. The current king has just launched a big building campaign, a big infrastructure campaign. They're building new buildings, people are getting shovel ready back to work. Things are looking good. Wall Street's booming. Right? And this Yahoo from the South shows up and starts castigating them. Okay, so you've been disobedient. Okay. So in this text, in the language and world of the text, is fear appropriate?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Right? And do you agree? People should be afraid.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So you agree that all the people of Israel should be afraid of God's punishment for wealth inequality and oppression of the poor.
I would always think that there could be some that, like, it's usually a group, and then there's some disobedient and some not.
Uh-huh. So
I'm always troubled by, okay, all the people of Israel, all the white folks, or all the black folks, this kind of thing. Because I think it's usually different shades of.
If I'm reading you right, hearing you right, you're saying it'd be nice if God came in and more kind of a surgical strike or a precise, right? Like, just get the cows of Bashan and the fat cats on Wall Street and the king, just sort of sweep them out, right? And not just the average hoi polloi, teacher, nurse, plumber.
I guess I want to suggest there's another thing being feared that needs to be filtered through there, because it comes out in the, I'm going to strip your defenses, I'm going to take away your idols. And there's an underlying sense, I think, of fear, like what we would think of in Make America Great Again. There is fear of the foreigner. We're building fortresses, we're building defenses, we're these idols, we're relying on them to address this fear.
Okay.
And so I think that there's a sense there of, when we get to, like, is this fear, should they be afraid? Perhaps yes, but then the message, I think, may be going to your Aquinas model. Is this an inappropriate, you know, are they going about addressing it the wrong way?
Okay. So you're thinking the defenses, sort of fear of the other or the outside,
right.
Other nations, okay?
Or, you know, poverty, whatever it is. And so part of the message is, you're going about this the wrong way, dude, and I'm going to show you how useless your way, your other way is.
Okay. So on that reading, the what's being drawn is a breakdown of their fears of the wrong kind, and being educated in the fears of the right kind in some way.
And addressing and relying on the only proper defense.
Okay. So this way. So you have to rely on God and not walls and wards. Is that sort of captured?
Yeah.
Okay. Alright. Excellent. Let me circle back for 1 second and stick with this point here. Okay. Notice how God describes this attack. This is on, lost my place. I just love the imagery now.
12.
12.
12.
Yeah, now I'm up there or something. There, thank you, 12. And you got me. Thus says the Lord, as the shepherd rescues from the mouth of the lion two legs or a piece of an ear, so shall the people of Israel who live in Samaria be rescued with the corner of a couch and a part of a bed. Okay. Scraps. So there's some differentiation going on. Some people are going to be left behind. But if you came to me and said, you know, I found the scrap of an ear of your sheep, here you go. Right. So what's difficult, I think, is to think about what that means for us. We'll talk about this when we get into questions of race and racism. But often I think there's this idea that we want those who are the really bad people, the real perpetrators, the real violators of justice, to receive punishment. And those of us who are just kind of in the middle, you know, just kind of getting by, doing what we can, like, we're gonna steer clear of any of the effects of this punishment that comes, or any effects of the difficulties that come. Right? And the prophets don't have that kind of image. Right? The burdens, the punishments will be shouldered by all, right? And oftentimes unequally. Right? You can imagine where the folks who are poor, the folks who are oppressed, might actually end up worse off for some time because of all of this. Right? It's a much darker image. Right. Do you experience this kind of fear in your own life? Fear of God's wrath, or fear of having your fears shaken up? What did you say?
Global warming.
Yeah. Global warming? Yeah. That to you is this kind of fear? Okay. Others.
Well, it's also that your eyes off the pocket, but I'm not sure if it's you. Like idols, and you don't think anymore, and you just follow someone who can speak nicely.
Yeah. So you wonder, to what extent are we following false idols today?
Yeah.
And to what extent are we disobedient in these ways?
We just decide that anything that doesn't please us is fake in some way, and everybody gets to choose what is the truth that's basically not following the scripture.
I think it depends on what prophets you listen to today. Maybe you're listening to false prophets or...
Yes.
You're listening to Reverend William Barber or Kendrick Lamar or who, you know.
Yeah.
And so where do we get our news? Mm-hmm. How do we react to it? Do we buy into the rest of the culture? And how are we living our lives in response?
So there's a lot of different voices clamoring to be the prophetic voice, and which one is true, which one is false. Mm-hmm. Your point is just other sources like artists and entertainers and others who are also making us aware of things through visual and other media. Okay, good.
I've experienced in the last months many people say to me that they're fearful. They're fearful for our country. They're fearful for the world. They're fearful because they think that we are not living up to what America should be rather than what being great again. So I hear a lot of fear from people who have never ever said that they were fearful for our nation.
Okay. What happened to America? What happened to the country I know, the people I knew, the folks I thought I knew? Okay.
I think in regards to our relationship with God, I feel a lot of confusion maybe rather than fear. I don't get a sense that as a church, I think we've done a lot of work to not portray this punitive God, and so I don't have a sense that congregations gather on Sunday mornings out of complete fear of God's wrath. I just don't feel like that's predominant. So maybe there's confusion, though, in where God does stand in relation to our sin and to our fallenness. The text like this bring that back up is confusion as to how we understand God's action.
Sure. You know, I think I share your instincts here about most people in the pews. If you haven't guessed, I lean left, and I hang around a lot of folks who do. And there generally is this desire to focus heavily on the God of love, the God of welcoming, the God of invitation, particularly in these fearful and anxious times. But this is then to confront a passage and to think about a God who might meet our anxiety and fear with even greater fear, right? That here we are anxious about how things have gone wrong, be politically or socially, and then the fact is that God's going to resolve that problem by bringing more punishment and there'll be more difficulties in the road to come.
Approving the entrapment of poverty. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of people who reject and resist minimum wages, mm-hmm. leave people trapped in a low wage where they can scarcely live. Entrapment in poverty, where the corporation that hires them down there gets wealthier and wealthier, mm-hmm. and leave them there. That's a one that hurts me.
Yeah. Profiting off the labor of the poor.
Yeah.
Right. And leaving them in cycles of poverty. Let's get a couple more, then we're going to move on.
Yeah, just maybe another way of putting some of this stuff is, you know, fear of the consequences of what, you know, that there will be consequences for how we are living as a society. And thinking especially related to the climate question, that, you know, that there will someday be justice and we might be at the short end of the stick of that as a human race. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
More in the back.
It's poignant, I think, if you think about this in terms of United States being Israel, and what that, you know, what God currently feels about how we're doing. And it feels like as a nation, he does probably have a lot of judgment and harsh feelings about how we're doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not sure I feel fear about that, but I feel, wow, okay, I need to, how do we hold that and hold it not just as the person that's not paying them the wage, but because I'm a part of the society and benefit from it. And so it's heartening. And it's,
yeah. Sobering, awakening.
Sobering.
Yeah, yeah.
Excuse me. So, can I wait?
Oh, sorry, I can't see you up there. Sorry.
No, sorry. So I maybe read this way because of our lack of context, but to me it seemed like this was more, I took it more personally, like God holding us, holding me, whatever, to a higher standard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you don't meet that standard, then you'll suffer, you know, in some way. And maybe that acting does relate to these sorts of, these bigger issues. I mean, mm-hmm. we each play a role individually.
Right. Yeah, it's hard for us to forget sometimes that the systems are made up of people, individuals.
Yeah.
Right? They aren't just sort of things that exist without the actions, beliefs, and behaviors of all of us. Right. So getting us to think more about the individual charges, the individual need for correction as a part of this larger social and systemic. Yeah.
So the their cause, he knew them best, so they knew better.
Yeah.
Right?
One hopes.
Yeah,
you're the ones that I saved, that I brought out of Egypt. You're the ones that I gave the law to. You're supposed to do better than this. So, all right. We can move on, otherwise I'll be doing Monday's things on Wednesday still. And that won't be.
We're almost done with Monday now.
What's that? Almost, yes. It's weird of the week, we're almost done with Monday. All right. I'm going to skip Psalm 34. Okay? All right. So I hope you can see then just how important and how fruitful it can be to sort of dive into some of these texts and just really think and pause and give yourself a chance to reflect on what kind of fears are being addressed here. Where are these fears coming from? Are they legitimate or not? And in what places is in our lives individually, right, and collectively is God calling us to be not afraid, as he was in the Isaiah text, or to be rightly afraid, as I think he is in the Amos text. All right. I'm going to do a hard shift from the 8th century BCE to the 16th century. So hold on to your seats as you turn a sharp corner here. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about Martin Luther, not just because I wore my Luther shirt today, and say what it is that I think that Luther adds to our reflections and our conversation about fear in the Christian life. Okay. So, for those of you who don't know, this is Martin Luther. Or a close facsimile thereof, in his like middle age years. You can tell how old a picture of Luther is based on how thin he is. In his monastic days, he's, you know, very tight-skinned, gaunt sort of Luther. And in his death mask, he's had a few beers and a few rockwurst, and he's enjoyed married life very well. Not unlike myself. Luther was born into an upwardly mobile family. Much like Holden Village, it was a copper mine that gave his family the wealth that they had. Gonna keep doing that. Okay. In 1483, he trained in university, got a bachelor's and master's. He was on the fast track into a program in law after that, but he jumped ship and joined the Augustinian Monastery. In fact, he joined an observant Augustinian monastery, which is like the Augustinians who thought the other Augustinians weren't trying hard enough. I just love medieval monastics. They're all just like competing with each other to see who can be like more strict, more hardcore. Like, oh yeah, we're going to stop wearing shoes. Take that. each other. While like some of them are also off like having concubines and all kinds of horrible things. So there's this like weird like competition among the best of the best. And the other guys are just kind of like, yeah, you guys do that. We're going to be not so great. So I just find it really exciting. It's like daytime TV. 1,000 years. All right. So Luther decides to join the Augustinians, and this is in large part because of his experience of spiritual struggle. One of the more famous stories is when he's walking on the road back to school. There's a lightning strike in a tree nearby. There's this big storm. And he throws himself on the ground and prays to St. Anne and says, you know, if you save me, I will become a monk. And he does. He is saved. He has become a monk. But the thinking is that it wasn't just a sort of one random lightning storm that made Luther become a monk. Right? The kind of struggles, the kind of fears that he had went back throughout his early life and lasted throughout the end of his life, from thin to not thin Luther. And so because of this, Luther's theology was particularly shaped by a strong focus on just what a struggle the Christian life can be, right? How it can be a life of affliction, a life that faces many challenges. Right? So in part, Luther's focus on struggle, as I said, is based on his experience, but also Luther is dipping into the tradition that he finds himself a part of, getting more and more excited and interested in mystics, various kinds, particularly German mystics. And so he becomes convinced in his thinking that, in fact, being a Christian will bring one into greater conflict, that will bring one deeper struggles, that will bring one deeper fears. Right? So it's an image of the Christian life where being a Christian doesn't make your life happier, necessarily, or better or easier. In fact, it's the complete opposite. It makes your life more difficult, more challenging. He says, in contrast to others, we who want to be Christians endure all kinds of troubles and misfortunes, so that people despise and vilify us, revile and slander us. Okay? Now, when Luther talks about being struggling as a Christian, the sort of persecution and fear Christians suffer, it's different than what you hear on TV today about Christians suffering. Okay? So on or about like November 1st or whatever, the news cycle will start kicking up again about the war on Christmas. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but some of the recent Pew surveys have shown that just a major percentage of Christians in America believe that Christians are persecuted. I don't understand it. It's baffling, but the number's been increasing, like every year for the last 10 years. Just a growing percentage of Americans who are Christians are convinced that Christians are being attacked. It comes in small ways, they think, like the all-red Starbucks cup that doesn't have any more Christmas images on it. Right? This is a subtle way of trying to sneak Mao's red book or something onto the Starbucks cup and push Jesus out. No, I just love this cartoon. The War on Christmas. If it were that exciting, I'd be a little more interested, actually. Right, but this idea that somehow Santa Claus and angels and Jesus are all under attack by the forces of secular humanism who are mounted against us. That's not what we're talking about. Right? That's not what being persecuted as a Christian means, but struggling as a Christian means. Luther puts it this way. I have a couple of long quotes here. But this fear and woe caused by God's wrath really pierces the Christian's heart. The fear of eternal death, screen flashing away, of becoming partners of the devil in the abyss of hell. This haunts one day and night. Against this, the Christian has to contend, well, my sweating blood. Now, there's a part of my soft liberal heart that wants to sort of distance myself from Luther's deep belief in the activities of the devil and the devil's minions in the world, and his deep belief of these devils attacking. Right? There's a part of me who lives in this world and realizes that the more I pay attention, the more his words seem quite accurate. Right? And Luther's fear here, his warning, right, is that the longer you're sort of in this world, the more the devil sort of attacks you, the greater threat there is of you becoming partners with the devil. Right? So again, as Lutherans, as many Lutherans in this room, we tend to focus about grace. I'm saved by grace. I've done nothing. I can contribute nothing. Oftentimes, Luther speaks about real possibilities of not being saved and of finding ourselves aligned with the devil. Hearing Lutheran pastor's sermons and reading Luther's sermons is a very different experience. He's very focused on grace, don't get me wrong, but he is really holding out the strong possibility that most folks who say they're Christian are just partners of the devil, wittingly or not, and are not going to enjoy the blessed life. Okay? He's a lot more hardcore than I am. So, what's Luther's response to this? He says, I must comfort myself in such terror and fear, pull myself together by faith and say to the devil and to my heart, you frighten me with sin and hell, but Christ tells me of heaven, righteousness, life, and eternal bliss. He must have greater weight with me than all my feelings and ideas. And thus we must ever struggle and resist, firmly holding and clinging to this article. This will be necessary both in life and in death. Okay. So Luther doesn't leave us with just the fear of punishment and the devil. But notice how he says, you're never going to leave that fear behind. Right? Lutherans love the word dialectic. Right? You're going to cling to, ultimately, these promises of Christ and in Christ and heaven, but you're also going to need to hold on to that fear, that real questioning about to what extent am I aligned with God, and to what extent have I become, again, wittingly or not, an instrument or a companion or a partner of the devil and the devil's work. So, Luther's advice sometimes sounds like what we think of as bootstrapping, right? He has this great letter to his barber where it sort of sounds like he's just telling his barber to stop being so depressed, stop being so afraid, just start feeling better. That's not quite what he means, even though it kind of sounds like that sometimes. In his letter to his barber, in his commentary on Corinthians, he is really pushing people to rely on not just themselves, but on others, and two groups of others in particular. The first is one thing I love about Luther. Often his advice is very mundane, very pastoral, in the like farmer sense of pastoral, like real ruddy, in the earth kind of things. What you need to do if you're feeling down and afraid and terrified is you need to have some bread and some sausage, right? Go have a big hearty meal. Not at Bolton, I'm discovering. Stahegan, I've heard, has meat, so I'll be going down there at some point in a canoe or something. Okay. So Luther thinks you need to have a hearty meal. You need to have a beer or seven, right? You need to find some people that you can put yourself in the presence of. And so, again, it seems like that's kind of obvious advice, and kind of easy, right? But I found it to be surprisingly not, right? That it's actually sometimes very hard to want to go out and have a beer with people when you're sort of overwhelmed by fear and anxiety, or want to gather with people Sunday or any other day when you're sort of in the throes of fear and anxiety. So I think Luther's advice actually here is quite good, right? Finding ways to place yourself into situations and communities, to surround yourself with people who are going to help you in the midst of this fear. Not to make it go away, right? But to help you put it in perspective, and help you find ways to work and live in it and through it. Okay? So, have a beer. I know there's wine in some places. But of course, most important for Luther is going to be not just trusting on beer and friends, but trusting on the true friend we have in Christ, and particularly the promises that God has made in Christ that we receive through the scriptures and we receive in and through the church, the ministry of God's people. So, what does this look like? Believing in these promises as a way of fighting fear. Well, I think Luther really understands a lot of his understandings of fear and struggling with faith, fear in the midst of faith from Mark's Gospel. If you ever listened to a series of sermons on Mark's Gospel, you've been in the church for some time, you know that one of the key themes in Mark's Gospel is fear and the way that fear can sort of threaten the disciples. A couple of strong examples of that. Mark 4:35, right? Whenever I can, I try and find Lego Bible pictures. It makes it a little better. The story here in Mark, right, is the disciples are out on a boat with Jesus. Jesus has gone to sleep because he doesn't get motion sickness like I do. So Jesus is out cold. The storm comes in, lightning, the waves are tossing. They're like, aren't you concerned we're going to die? Right? And Jesus stands up. He rebukes the wind and says to the sea, peace be still. Then the wind ceased and there was a dead calm. And Jesus said to them, why are you afraid? Have you still no faith? And they were filled with great awe. Mm-hmm. Right? So again, the fear seems to be overwhelming the disciples, seems to be causing them to panic in ways that they probably shouldn't have, knowing they had Jesus in the boat. Okay. Another great example, in Mark 21, we have what I think was the lesson a few weeks ago, yeah? Those of you who remember the lectionary better than I do. A few weeks ago, we had the Jairus' daughter and the healing of the woman with the hemorrhage. I think that was from a different gospel, but I think we had it. Well, in that text, there are several mentions of fear, right? So the woman here, the woman with the hemorrhage, who reaches out to touch the hem of Jesus' cloak and is healed, right? It says she is afraid, right, when Jesus calls her out. Jesus sort of looks around and says, you know, who touched me? Who touched my clothes? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say you touched me? That's how they said it, exactly like that. Okay, Jesus, glass of water, get your feet up. Okay. And the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told the whole truth. It strikes me as an interesting way of describing her response in this situation. Right? She's just been healed, but now that Jesus has noticed this and has asked who touched his cloak, right, she's suddenly afraid. And she's afraid because she has to tell the truth. She has to sort of tell Jesus what's happened. It's me, I did it. Right? And to think about, why is she afraid in that situation? Does she not feel that she should be there? Was she afraid Jesus would take the healing back? Right? Where's that fear coming from? So she's moved by fear and trembling. And Jesus responds to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. So her fear here, Jesus calls faith. Right? In this weird sort of way. Her trembling before him, Jesus recognizes and blesses. Just after this, right, while he was still speaking, Jesus was still speaking, some people came back from the leader's house, from Jairus' house, and said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? Which, also, worst people ever, right? Stop bothering him, your daughter, Mary. But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. Okay. So again, Jesus has a complicated relationship with fear. But in Mark's gospel, his sense is that often the fear can overwhelm the disciples. It can lead them from being good listeners and good followers of his words. He wants this man to not be afraid because he's going to save his daughter. He wants to recognize this woman's fear because she stands in awe of his power and she stands in need of his healing. And he gives her the kind of blessing that she's looking for. So again, places where fear is at work, Jesus is trying to dispel it, but again, it's always going to be there. All right. I'm going to end today by doing a little turn again. So we're talking about how can we wrestle with and use and respond to these fears in our lives, in the Christian life. And so I'm going to end today by using the language of courage. And this, pick back Thomas again. So as I was saying, our fear, as Thomas understands it, is totally natural. It's part of who we are. And it can cause us to withdraw from things. Something I didn't mention yesterday is that Thomas describes fear as a kind of contraction, sort of a pulling in, a tightening, right? Which kind of makes sense when you think about when you're afraid and your fight or flight instincts kick in and your gut tightens up and you're ready to get moving. So he describes love as a kind of reaching out. Love is a desire to have or to be with something. Love of God is the desire to be united with God, kind of always be in God's presence, be with God. And fear is the kind of tightens you up and pulls you in. Okay? So in the face of fears that you need not have or should not have or need to work through, what you need in response to that, Thomas will say, is courage or fortitude. And so fortitude is about pressing on in the face of fear and learning to moderate and withstand one's fears. Okay, so again, not getting rid of them, but learning to keep going, to keep moving. Right? Not stopping being afraid, But when you're afraid, spending time with your friends drinking beer, or spending time with your compatriots planning and plotting what you're going to do to address these situations that are making you so afraid, politically, economically, and socially. What I love about Thomas, this is some of you in passing yesterday, I love Luther, obviously, because I think he speaks to the Christian experience so well. But in terms of like organizational structure, his writings are kind of a mess sometimes. Because he's much like me, actually. He's sort of writing as situations arise. He's an occasional writer. He's trying to address things that are coming up. Ideas are flying. He's cranking stuff out. And structure, organization, it kind of gets lost sometimes. Thomas just loves structure. If you ever have a chance to read any of Thomas's writings, I say it's like reading stereo instructions. It's like, or like legal documents, like the party to the third part shall be agreed to do, like just sort of goes on and on like that. There's like no real life in Thomas's writing. So I think they work well together. Right? Thomas brings the structure, Luther brings some heart and soul, and that's what I like. All right. But what I do love about Thomas's structure is how nicely he pairs and opposes these different virtues and vices in our life. So the virtue of courage, which helps us overcome or endure through things that are difficult and frightening, comes packaged with other related virtues. You've got to need magnanimity, which is a hard word to say, patience, perseverance, and it's opposed to these collection of vices. Right? So Thomas thinks that fear can become a vice. Right? It can become more than just sort of our natural response to the dangers losses in our lives. It can become a habit that we live into and build up and get stuck in. Okay. But likewise, on the other side, as I said yesterday, he thinks fearlessness is also a vice. Right? You don't want to be without fear, because you're going to die or do some real stupid things or stop loving people. Presumption, ambition, vainglory, all of these he thinks are excesses of courage in some way or another. Too much confidence. Versus pusillanimity.
Really?
One of those nice GRE words, have you ever taken an SAT word or whatever? It means sort of a weakness of spirit, weakness of soul. So let me give you an example. Elizabeth, give me a compliment.
Oh, Anthony, you're just so beautiful.
No, I'm not beautiful. I'm weird looking. My ears are too big. I have this long hair.
That's pusillanimity?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
It's the language of Minnesota many times. What's that?
Minnesota nice.
Minnesota nice, but even more than that, it's the inability to receive any sort of positive compliment about yourself.
Yeah.
Right? You can't see yourself as capable of doing anything, and can't stand when people sort of call you out and say, like, what a great job Hank did. It's amazing. Like, you know, that would sort of shrink into yourself. You contract, right? Sort of pull into yourself and resist. Okay? So that's a deficiency. Right? You don't have enough fortitude. You don't have enough courage. Thomas thinks that each of these vices are deadly in our lives, right? Someone who can't receive encouragement, let's stick with pusillanimity here, right, might then not try to do difficult things. Right? All these virtues and vices concern things that are difficult. And so if you think, I'm not really a good public speaker, you're never going to speak out. I'm not really organized. You're never going to organize anybody. I'm not good at money. You're going to get worse at it. You keep telling yourself that. Right? And so to not believe in oneself or to believe in oneself too much, these are both real problems. So when dealing with courage, and I hinted at this yesterday, which is perfect. Okay. Traditionally, in the philosophical and theological traditions, a lot of folks thought that death in battle was a cheap example of courage, right? There's all kinds of ways we can see courage playing out in our lives, great and small. Folks would say the greatest example of courage is this person, usually a man, usually some sort of strong, chubby man with lots of muscles with some toxic masculinity attached to it. Some man who charges into battle, right, who takes the foxhole, I don't know. All these other kinds of things from all the Steven Spielberg movies I've watched since growing up. So, courage is being brave in battle. Thomas rejects this. He says, it's great and all. Right? He's not against the military or against folks fighting in battles. He's a just warrior kind of guy. But he says that martyrdom is the chief example of what courage looks like. So he said, martyrdom consists essentially in standing firmly to truth and justice against the assaults of persecution. Notice there. Martyrdom isn't just dying for the faith. If you think of maybe early church martyrs, something like that. It's not being beheaded or fed to lions. It's standing firmly to truth and justice against the assaults of persecution. So for Thomas's thinking, whenever you stand for truth and justice, you're standing with God, because God is truth and God is justice. Okay? So, with Thomas and Luther, we're being, I think, simultaneously supported for our fears, right? So you should have some fears, and encouraged to keep trusting and fighting in the midst of them. What I want us to think about, kind of the rest of this week, if you do this right here, is if martyrdom, as Thomas says, is the chief example of Christian courage, what does martyrdom look like as a Christian in a nation where Christians are the dominant and we control the levers of power, be it cultural, political, or economic, right? What's it going to be a martyr, to have that kind of courage in today's society? As one example of that, the rest of this week, Wednesday through Friday, we're going to take up racism, both inside and outside the church, as a place where some Christians, I say, need to have their fears ameliorated. Some Christians are afraid because of racism, and those fears need to be taken away. They need to hear fear not. We'll get some of that tomorrow with Dr. King. Others need to have their fears stoked. Right? Some folks aren't afraid enough. Right? They need to fear more. Okay? And we need to figure out where suffering and sacrifice are being demanded, from whom and what ways. Okay? So the task for us is going to be, again, to unpack what kind of fear is being called for, what kind of courage is going to be needed, and how we need to stand up for truth and justice. As Christians in our society. So, that's it for today. Tomorrow, Martin Luther King and his fears of the white moderate, which I'm sure we don't have any of those in here. What that would be like. But for today, here's some questions. I was talking for a long time there. Yes?
We've been talking about fear always as being afraid or being scared. Mm-hmm. But getting to Martin Luther, when I learned the meanings to the commandments a long time ago, we said we should fear, love, and trust in God so that I never thought that I was supposed to be scared of God. I mean, that didn't seem to go with love and trust. It was more like thinking I should be in awe of God. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the question is, but...
Yeah. So, like I said, I wrestle with that, too, as someone who tends to be anxious about fear, about wanting to see God as punishing and threatening. But I'm coming more and more to think that fear should also include being scared, right? I think Luther points us in the direction of saying that you don't end in that sort of scared place, that you know that at the end of all, that Christ's promises are still going to hold you, and you have to trust in that. But then if you move too quickly past being scared, right, you're going to miss the things that God wants you to be scared of, the good you haven't done, or the evil you have. I think a little bit of being scared is necessary.
So we should say, we should be scared and love and trust God.
So he says fear. He means fear, love, and trust. Do all those things at the same time.
Well, I think of it being the offending is you, but also I think respect. Yeah. You know, it's as far as what God is doing. You know, like water is good. Swimming is fun in the water. But you need to respect the ocean, the rivers, the streams, and what you can and cannot do, maybe. I don't know.
I hear you, and I'm still going to push back just a little bit.
Okay.
Right? Because I think, like, the word respect or the word awe creates some distance between me and the object. Or like, I respect lots of things that I don't feel sort of deeply in my guts about. Right? I respect this thing. I respect opera. I don't have strong feelings about it otherwise. Apologies to the operatic types. Right? But fear, to be scared, that gets me right here. It gets into my bones, into my heart. Not that you need to be scared all the time. Luther, Thomas, nobody's saying that. But there, you ought to have some fear in your life, right? About where is God acting? Am I acting with God? What powers and principalities am I participating in? Not that you have the answers definitively to all those questions. But if there's not some fear in you from time to time.
Healthy fear?
Healthy fear, yeah. Natural fear, necessary fear. If for nothing else, if you're looking at your life and thinking, I don't have any fears, then you're probably missing the fears of someone you love. Right? And if nobody you know or in relationship with has any fears, then we need to talk after this session. Something's not right there. Right? If you're not close enough to other people or to yourself to know the things that you're afraid of and to actually feel them in your bones and in your gut, something's not right, I would dare to say.
I mean, some of this conversation, I think, maybe has to do, too, with how, you know, we think of, sometimes we talk about the Old Testament God as the, you know, as the you know, wrathful God that smites the, you know, and kills the women and children and the like. You know, and I think part of our reaction to not wanting to fear God in that way is that, I mean, that is a, well... Yeah, I mean, I don't believe in a God that does that. You know, on the other hand, that there are, you know, when I used that word consequences before, there are consequences. I mean, if God is justice and love, and then, you know, there are consequences to us following another path. And maybe that gets to what are those forces, you know, if we think of, you know, Luther talked about the devil and demons, and, you know, what are those things today? How do we understand those, like, you know, Walter Winks kind of, you know, engaging the power? So I think maybe that's a way through some of this, you know, that, it, no, it's not maybe that God that is, you know, sending down lightning bolts on the, you know, on the, you know, the women and children, but there are consequences of the actions that we take that are against God's love and justice.
That's great, yeah. So I like this. I'm still resistant a little bit, right? Because notice you've removed God's agency from those consequences.
Yeah,
it just sort of seems like there are these consequences that happen sort of naturally, and then there's God who doesn't.
Yeah, I'm somewhere in between two. I don't know how to put it, but yeah, but it but there's a problem with some of that, you know, Old Testament imagery that we, and but how do we understand that now, and that there is a price to pay, and that it does relate to who God is. So mm-hmm. I mean, so I'm with you on that. It's
can I say something to that? Because certainly. I think most likely in the same boat. I think it's a little bit like parenting techniques, maybe. So like.
Right.
In the old times, they would spend the children until they cry and are like really bloody on their butt or something. And nowadays, there are still consequences because they are not like spanking your kids, but like showing them the right way and being also strict. So it's like we have a different kind of God, but it's still that the God is acting out the consequences. And so the magnitude of you might be different. That you're not like scared and trembling in your shoes, but that you know that you should be mindful and respectful and actually follow it. There might be something happening you don't like. It's not just, yeah, that you're just struck down by lightning, but you may not have given your compliment.
Yeah, it's good. So you're sort of pointing us to there are going to be different things that God does. We might say that some of the things people in the past have said that claimed as God's punishments or God's actions, we want to say that's not actually how we understand God operating, while still holding on to the belief that just like any good parent or any good relationship, that God does deliver consequences.
Right.
God does deliver punishments. Yeah, there's just a whole lot of theology tied up in this that I've been about for a long time. Right. We'll move on. One more question, sorry. One more comment.
There's another one that I confuse with the fear,
uh-huh.
The phobia. And what comes to me when we say fear not,
uh-huh.
There are people who are afraid of some animals like the chameleon. And to somebody who is afraid of a chameleon, the message would be fear not. You do not fear a chameleon.
Uh-huh.
It's not harmful.
Well, then, yeah.
But it looks like the fear, the phobia comes different to different people.
Right. Yeah, there are some things you shouldn't be afraid of, some things you should, and sort of paying attention to that, right?
Yeah.
Although I said yesterday, the moths are something you should be afraid of. Okay. This has been excellent. Thank you all again for a wonderful conversation today. Go enjoy some of the good coffee next door on your way out, and we'll see you all back here tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Thank you.